episode 15 of To the Unknown Pod. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media, which exists to help Christians understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. I am joined by somewhat the normal cast of characters and then one very abnormal character, friend of the pod, Pastor J. Chase Davis. We'll let him introduce himself in just a second. But before that, Ash, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, Jim, Tim, afterwards.
Sure. Oshua Hawthorne, live in Portland, Oregon. I'm the founder and director of a kingdom startup lab and incubator called Brilliance Labs. I'm also the proud dad of 8 kiddos, oldest going off to college this year and the youngest just 4 months old.
I'm Jim McAndrew. I'm tech support for a little organization called Magnolia.
I'm Tim Fox. Work with Jim with Magnolia, trying to orange pill the church, help them see the ways that Bitcoin can help them preach the gospel more faithfully and for the long term.
And as I mentioned, we're happy and very grateful to have Pastor Chase Davis here with us. Chase, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. Chase Davis. I host a podcast called Foolproof Theology, pastor at the Well Church in Boulder, Colorado. I've been here since 2011. Have a couple of degrees, if that matters to anyone. It doesn't seem to anymore. And just glad to be here.
Chase, online lightning rod, turner upside downer of worlds in some people's minds. We're grateful to have him here. Chase is here because he recently penned an article or typed, I don't know if we call that penned, called "The Church Planting Bubble is About to Burst." Within this article, he then talked about topics that we've been talking about in the last few episodes of the podcast here about patronage and just what does ministry look like in a very different world, in a rapidly changing world. So we saw this article, read it, thought to myself, man, I'd love to have Chase on so that Tim can attack him and ask him questions of what he means, one of our favorite things. And so that's why you're here. So Chase, why don't you just kind of give us some background around why you wrote the article, how you came to write the article. Just give an intro to the audience. We'll share this in the show notes.
That's great. Yeah. So I church planted in 2011 with my best friend, Matt Patrick. It was his idea to plant, and I was happy to come along and help out and serve in that way. And so out of our church plant, we've planted, at this point, 5 other churches working on our 6th. And so we have some experience with church planting and what it takes to church plant. Our church planting has been fairly independent of major organizations. We're happy, like we have a church planter that has partnered with the Sin Network, the SBC's church planting. We've had a church planter that's partnered with the Presbyterian Church Planting Network. And so we've done that and several other networks as well. And so the background was stuff that I had been thinking about for a while as we had planted the church, seen the struggles of a church, and kind of been fed a narrative from either these church planting organizations or other networks about church planting and what it's going to look like. I'll give you an example. The same thing that happens in much of evangelicalism, where you bring the guy who was like a drug addict yesterday, became a Christian, now he's clean, and now we're going to celebrate his testimony, which is a good thing. The same thing happens in church planting. You'll typically hear the success stories. You'll hear about the guy in St. Louis who was handed this beautiful building just free of charge. And he was able to get in there and renovate it and continue to grow his church. And this is, you know, how they attract an audience and recruit church planters. And for many church planters, this isn't reality. This isn't what they experience. And it is a grind. It's a lot of fundraising. It's very, it actually gets into a lot of like social networks. So for example, when my background, I grew up in the church. So I had Christians in my life from birth. So I had many Christians that supported missions and church planting and that kind of thing. Matt, who I pastor with, did not grow up in the church. He has no background that would lend itself to a social network that would advantage him to fundraise and recruit for church planting. And that can be an impediment. And so that's just a small example of the challenges that you face. And so the big one is the fundraising thing. So when I meet new church planters and we have our residency program and we work through a lot of, you know, inventory of who they are and why they want to plant a church, by the 3rd quarter out of 4 in that residency, we're going to talk about the plan. What's your plan to plant a church? As much as we like to think of the church as not planned out. I mean, I'm talking to many Presbyterians, so maybe they don't think that way, but many evangelicals think that way. It's important to have a plan, especially when it comes to order and finances. And so for a lot of church planners, they have this idea of like, well, I want a budget of this, and I need this much in America today to live. And so then we help them kind of work out based on where they're planting, how much they're going to need to raise based on that, based on they're going to have to pay a rental fee, probably, unless they can find a Seventh-day Adventist church or another church that's going to let them meet in their building at another time. Mm. And so we work that out. So for example, we had one church planner that was like, I want to make, let's say $150,000. I don't remember exactly, because we live in Colorado. It's very expensive and he had many kids. And so we were like, that's great. You want your church to be smaller? And he, yeah, like that's my ideal. He really didn't like mega churches. We kept trying to work on that with him to appreciate mega churches for what they are, not just hate on mega churches and be a reactionary.
Define mega church. How big are we talking here? Are we talking
12, over like 2,000? I'm talking over 2,000 people. Like okay. That to me is like very, you know,
yeah.
That's industry.
Yeah.
And so, anyways, we're like, look, based on where you want to be and how you want to grow, you're never going to have like a kids ministry. And that's fine. If that's your like DNA of your church, we're kind of either family integrated, whatever you want to articulate, mm-hmm. but you're not ever going to be able to afford anyone else on staff. So is your wife okay, like helping with the kids every week? If you want to have a kids ministry, you know, these kind of tensions yeah. are what we talk about in the residency program to help that church planner get off the ground so we can have a fundraising strategy and all that kind of stuff. And so that's a lot of where the article came from. And so what I'm seeing today, 2025, after church planting was kind of a big sell, you might say, a big movement at least in evangelicalism for the last, you could go up to half century, but quarter century, is there seems to be a decline in the pipeline of the people interested in planting. There seems to be a lot of hardships financially. There seems to be a high, what do you want to call it, burnout or just churn in terms of like in Boulder. So another contextual thing is that we've seen 100 church plants come and go since we moved here.
Holy cow.
And so it's a very difficult place because it's so expensive and and it's very lost, but it's really yeah. like finances are a big deal. The big things that ruin a church plant are finances and leadership if those don't go well.
Yep.
And so we've seen that. And so we keep asking ourselves a question, how can we help people do it better? Not that we have, you know, the best ideas out there. For some reason, God in his mercy let our church plant succeed. And we're here 15 years later, I think it is now, 14 years. And we have a building and now we feel like more like a church and not a church plant anymore. So we're asking these questions to try and help other people assess the landscape with a bit of sober-mindedness that I sense was not present maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, this is just so, again, for Chase, for your benefit. So Ash has planted a church in Hawaii where he grew up. I planted a church, helped plant a church in Uruguay in South America. Tim's at a church plant. Tim and Jim are at a church plant now. Tim helped, pastor a church in Austin, Texas. So again, we all, this is very close to home for all of us. So I'll just ask between Ash and Tim, which one of you kind of wants to kind of start out and just kind of get your thoughts on the article and just questions that you would have for Chase based on what he wrote.
I think we've talked about too, this, one of the points you made Chase was this idea that building ministry around charisma and kind of being an entrepreneur and that is highly prioritized in American Christianity and just in American culture in general, at the expense of looking at the actual biblical qualifications that talk about mainly about character and a little bit about skill, mainly teaching. So you talked about, you know, this focus on being the entrepreneur type guy who can go out and, you know, plant the church and go a million miles an hour and it just kills most guys. And I've heard the same thing. I talked to a guy in the PCA's arm of church planting a year or two ago, and he said the same thing you're saying, that they've struggled to find guys to do it and there's a lot less interest and there's a lot of people who just aren't interested. You talk in the article about moving towards patronage as a way of kind of making things financially stable. Do you think, I sometimes wonder if, and I've been thinking about this, of do the patrons of the church today need to be discipled into patronage? Because I'm afraid that if we just equate patrons with the rich people in the church,
sure,
the rich people in American churches will tend to be self-made, very successful business people.
Right.
With a lot of ideas about how, what you have to do to be successful. And I, I wonder if they will say you handed in the keys to the church and you said you're going to fund the church and the pastor. If with that, there's a real danger that they would expect the pastor to be an entrepreneur who kind of runs things like a business like they have. I wonder if being a patron in the theological sense or the church historical sense means a pretty different understanding of your wealth and of how to spend it. You know what I mean? Is there a danger there that we just say, oh, hand it to the rich people and not quite think of it in terms of you're a patron, not a successful businessman with money?
Yeah, this is what we've tried. I mean, there's a book we've handed out called Gospel Patron, and I find it pretty helpful on this topic. The way I thought of it and the way I tried to articulate in the article was thinking like if I were to send a church planter, instead of thinking for a lot of church planters, they discern their calling or discern their context, either by instinct, by opportunity, by sensing the Lord. A lot of, you know, we've heard a lot of that here in Boulder. They'll get up on a mountain and feel very inspired. And they tell us they hear from the Lord that they need to plant a church here. And we try to help them discern that calling. But I was thinking more like, what would it look like for a group in, let's say, Kansas City of 10 people, 10 families who say, we're going to start a church and we're going to call a pastor. We're not expecting any one of us to be the pastor. We're instead going to pray and initiate a church plant on our own and then call a pastor in. And so it's immediately funded, so to speak, by patrons who are invested rather than what typically happens in a lot of evangelicalism, whether you want to talk about ARC, church planting, Acts 29, whatever it may be with parachute plants, is you're taking outside money. It's like a mission trip type thing. And that's not necessarily wrong, but you're raising up funds from outside. Then you're having to raise up givers from inside. And there typically reaches a point where those outside givers want to drop off and invest in other gospel work. And maybe these inside givers are not able to sustain that work. So it has less to do with like the rich people. It has more to do with like if somebody in a different context, a group of Christians, let's say 10 families, were to start and say, we're going to start a church plant and we're going to call a pastor from somewhere else to kind of lead us. And we're not expecting him to be entrepreneurial. We just want him to do the job of a pastor. Like we want him to be our pastor. And this is what the Puritans did. This was what Thomas Hooker, they had Thomas Hooker's company. He came over on the Griffin. And when he arrived, they were like, you're here. We summoned you. And then they tore down the boat and they built a church out of the wood of the boat. And so that's how they called him. And that's how I conceive of patronage more.
So is it more that moving from external funding to internal funding, like you should pay your own pastor?
Yeah. Yeah. You could think of it like that. I'm thinking more of like, you know, Christians anywhere who want to see a new, you know, church or something like that. What would it look like for them to gather or network with a denomination and say, can you call a pastor for us? Or we're going to call a pastor ourselves and here's how much we're going to, you know, we're going to set up a budget and this is what we're going to do, rather than kind of the typical model, which is the pastor is the entrepreneur, the fundraiser. And this is why you see pastors, they end up, what do they do when they leave the ministry? If they're church planters, they leave the ministry, they typically end up in insurance, car sales, some kind of sales, real estate, because they're a good salesman. They have the charisma that is concordant with the entrepreneur skill. So
I love the direction that you're taking this. And within the Bitcoin space, we talk a lot about financial incentives, right? And the role that financial models have on the behavior of people. A number of years ago, I kind of had my, I don't know what the right red pill moment is with church planting. So my background, I church planted right out of Bible college. I was with Acts 29. I was in the early years, back before the really robust, quote unquote, like grilling session and cohort based assessments. I literally, the director of Acts 29 took me out for a beer and he liked me or thought I was cool enough. And he just shook my hand and I was in. And I'm kind of oversimplifying, but really that was about what it was. This is circa 2005. But a red pill moment for me was a conversation I had with a local Portland church planner and missiologist, Sean Banesh. I don't know if you guys know Sean. He's written a number of books on rethinking church planning, finances, and bivocational work. And he was doing his doctorate work studying church planning. And he said this to me. He says, you know, in the 70s and 80s, God really loved white suburbanites. And then in the early 2000s, he discovered white urban hipsters. Mm. And I'm like, Sean, what are you even talking about? He says, oh, yeah, no, for sure, because God must really love them because that's who he sent all his church planters to. Right? So you study the history of church planting. There was this big, like the old mega church seeker sensitive movement, and you had all the white flight out into the suburbs, and then that's where all the churches got started. And then we listened to Tim Keller and rediscovered the urban core, and it was cool to be urban. And then all the church planters went there. And so Sean's done a lot of work of looking at the financial incentives and the models where we kind of like take this, like you mentioned, this time horizon, 3 to 5 year kind of ticking time bomb of funding, where you have this long to gather a core, to get critical mass, to launch your service, and it's make it or break it. And basically, you have all the financial incentive to run quickly, break things, steal other people's sheep, because you're not going to disciple pagans into fully like tithing mature believers in a year or two or three, right? So you're not going to be able to fund your salary and your building unless you're getting other already mature believers that are disgruntled somewhere and happen to show up. That's the low-hanging fruit, right? And so the whole model is built to not necessarily effectively reach the loss, but to attempt to effectively build your budget and create a sustainable church model, which then we will reach all the broken people and lost people once we kind of have our service going, is the idea. And it is true, younger churches reach more lost people. Yes, they are more effective. Yes, we read the essay from the 90s. Yes, let's start new churches. But the financial model just... It led to a certain type of church, a certain type of burnout. And then, like you said, dude, you're on year four. You don't have a sustainable gathering. Time to go be a used car salesman.
Yeah.
And I'm in Portland, which has its own like turnover of church planting. And like we've read that story before.
Yeah.
So now what I find interesting in what you're saying is it's different. So Sean's model is this bivocational model, which you kind of mock in your essay. And he makes the distinction between, oh, I work at Starbucks so I can kind of like pay the bills, to I'm a small business entrepreneur that builds a sustainable funding model for my family so I can have a long time horizon. So he'll suggest something like, hey, don't just work at a Starbucks, start a coffee shop. So be a small business owner, be in the community long-term so that, hey, if the church takes 5+ years to get started, you don't have to go home to mama. You can actually stay and build trust and relationship and let the church flow out of the discipleship relationships that you've formed.
Okay.
It's more of a long-term like missionary model where you're going to raise your support.
Yep.
Or build your like revenue stream,
sure,
based on what you're bringing, and then you're just there long term. Like no one expects to plant a sustainable church plant in 3 years in Uzbekistan,
sure,
right? But we expect that you can do it in Portland, Oregon.
Well,
which
I think
is crazy.
One of the unique opportunities, if I can weigh in on that, because bivo and bivocational for me, it was introduced to me by kind of these emergent thinkers like Hugh Halter, Matt Smelter. I think is his name. Matt Smay was his kind of collaborator there. And so he like started a painting business, right? And a legit, not like mafia style, we paint houses, like a painting business. And so that was his deal. I still think that pressure to both start a business and start a church at the same time is an inordinate amount of pressure to expect of a church planner. One, I think that many young men looking for ministry opportunities today, that's pretty uninteresting, and it actually is against what we're trying to cultivate in church planners, which is be a pastor. Like, we want you to be a pastor. Now, some people may be gifted to go do that, and that's great. I've been part of starting businesses while I'm a pastor, so like I'm not opposed to that. I think there's two hangups I typically have with bivocational, because I agree, it can work. I think the best opportunity, especially today, is you have remote work opportunities with Christian companies where you can go plant the church, work remote, and you don't have to worry about starting a business on the side while you're trying to minister and pastor people at the same time. So you can have that freedom to where you can kind of clock out of something and have reliable pay there. That would be an option that would be appealing, I think, to many church planners. The second thing is with the concept of vocation itself. So, and this gets into kind of evangelicalism in America with calling, with what is the ideal that we're trying to shoot for. Now, Paul had his own model of ministry, tent maker. I mean, that was my kind of background. I got my undergrad in construction management. I was a project manager or project engineer for a general contractor, thinking that I would be like, kind of like Paul, and I was going to go over to Pakistan. That was my original kind of thinking. Didn't work out. Wasn't a big fan of the Middle East. It turns out neither was my wife. And so we planted in Boulder, which is a lot easier, believe it or not. Some people dispute that, but I still think it's true. And so for me, like, I totally get the sentiment of kind of like starting a business and a church and all that to be invested in the community. At the same time, I think at the end of the day, in America, we need strong pastors who do the ministry well, who care for their people well, and that split kind of vocation model can lend itself. It can be good. I know of a pastor in Oklahoma is doing this to great success. He's a politician, runs a business, and a pastor, and they started the church that way. They said, we're all going to be bivocational, and we're going to share the pulpit. We're all going to be elders, and that's great. But there is a concern there for diminishing what we're trying to get to, which is established churches with faithful pastors who are paid for what they do in ministry.
Well, and I think Paul seems to assume and expect that churches should pay their pastors. And when he does do the tent making thing, I don't get the sense that he's so much doing it because, well, too bad they can't pay me. But with the Corinthians, at least, it's because he's refusing to take their money. They actually want to be his patrons. They want to pay him. But he's worried about what that will mean for them, because they will then expect to be able to boss him around and do what he wants. And he says, no, actually, I'm happy to take money from the poor Macedonians, but I refuse to take your money because I know where your hearts are at. But he is happy to say, you guys must pay your pastors.
Right.
Is their right. And you have to give it to them. I don't know. I have mixed feelings about the bivocational thing. I think sometimes it's like, yeah, okay, it can be good for engagement in the community. Maybe that's part of why Paul was doing it. But it can also just be like kind of a necessary evil of like, well, if you just can't make money, then okay, I guess, yeah, you got to go out and do that. But it's not ideal, or it's not some great, noble, wonderful thing to not get paid by your church.
Yeah, that's kind of where I come down. Is just like, I don't see anywhere where it's glamorized in this bivocational. I was like, this is the ideal. It's like, hey, no, planting churches is really important. And so we're willing to pay whatever costs in order to do that. But to try to glamorize it, I still just don't see it anywhere. And I think, again, to your point, Chase, like, it comes with big trade-offs in terms of just the amount of time, or at least it can come with big trade-offs in terms of focus, the amount of time that the pastor has to be able to focus on, again, just the spiritual needs of his church. Again, there's definitely jobs and situations where you can make significantly more money to where you can still give the focus where it's due. I don't know. What are some of the, I mean, what other kind of responses have you gotten from people in response to the piece? Has anybody, reached out to scream at you?
No, no one has. No, actually, believe it or not, no. Because it's just, it is a shot across the bow, but it's more like, these are things I've been thinking about for a while. And I'm fairly reasonable, hopefully, that, look, I know that bivocational, I kind of using Oshawa, that's how you say it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Using that analogy that, oh, look, God is moving in the white suburbs. Oh, look, God is moving in the cities. Oh, look, God is moving in bivocational ministry. It seemed like a big, like, marketing thing from, like, the Verge Network and all these guys that were super, quote-unquote, missional, who just so happened to have very liberal theology as well. And that made me immediately suspicious. I was like, I'm happy to hear you out and your arguments for the legitimacy of bivocational ministry. But when you make that kind of the new standard and say, this is how it always is going to work, or this is, and they typically sell it that way, it gives me a great deal of suspicion, because I'm like, it is an option. I'm going to say, I've done it. Like, I'm not opposed to it. It's just more like you're pitching young men on a vision for life that either they may not be able to attain to, they're not called to, that may be unsustainable. And I want to make sure those young men are brought up and discipled and matured. The other thing Oshawa mentioned was 3 to 5 years raising up elders. We were told as church planters, we were also part of Acts 29. Some of your listeners might know that story, but like a big emphasis was raising up elders. And so we, being young men who were like just trying to be good pastors in that network, we were like, well, they said we need to plant churches and raise up leaders. You got to have your leadership pipeline. So I had my Excel spreadsheet and, you know, we're going to have these quarterly seminars and we're going to bring in speakers. And we did the leadership pipeline and we're raising up elders. And we put men in place who ended up like, one's not attending church anymore, not just our church, like not any church, and another moved away. And it was rushed. And we used a lot of the Mark Driscoll, like high performance kind of like standards in that early elder process. That was very, it created a lot, and we could get totally sidetracked on this on how we raise up elders, but it created a lot of unnecessary problems for us because those demands, we got financially sustainable after 3 years by God's grace. And I was only 24 when we planted. So it wasn't because I was like, you know, a very successful person and knew what I was doing. I never worked in ministry before I planted the church. And so, by God's mercy and grace, we were able to do that. And there were some people that came from a closed church plant that closed. And there were a lot of people who were homeless Christians, so to speak. And of course, those people get attracted to a church plant for particular reasons.
Yeah.
But all that's kind of mixed up in what Oshawa was saying.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things where, I this is like a very hot take, but there's part of me that just, like, I look around at the Christian landscape, and there's a part of me that just looks around and goes, yeah, there actually we need to have a lot more churches close. Like there's a lot more churches. Like it would actually be better off in very real ways if a lot of churches would close, because like again there's so many people out there who, by virtue of the fact, again, there's a number of reasons for this, but by virtue of the fact that like the United States, one of the things that we talk about on this podcast a lot is just the United States has been the global reserve currency of the world. So their currency has more purchasing power, which enables you to do more of whatever you're trying to do. And so it's naturally meant in part that the United States has been one of the church planting, bastions around the world. And so what that's meant is there's a lot more resources to plant, you know, basically to fund people who shouldn't have been, who wouldn't be funded under normal circumstances. You could start a church that's really funded with 30 people, just given the nature of how much money is in America. And so one of the things that I've just been thinking about recently, I look at somebody like Elon, and he's talking about the need for us to populate the planet. We need more people. And so Elon completely divorces any ethics of people production. This is like borrowing from this principle within economic circles, which is this principle of the ethics of money production, that like you can't just go out and create money any way you want to. There's actual principles that have to govern these things in order for them to be done in ethical ways. And this same thing is true of disciples and even churches. Of like where Elon wants to go, hey, I have 13 children with 10 different women. Look how I'm helping. And we look at this and we're like, no, dude, because God has ways and he has means. And so this actually should look very differently. There should be parameters on the production of people in order to be helpful in the world, in order to accomplish the things that God wants to do. And so I would say the same thing ought to be true of disciples more broadly and churches. Like, it's not just that, yay, we have multiplication of churches, that this is automatically a good thing. It's like, no, how are these churches being produced? How are they being made? And so one of the things that I think is really, it's really important is like when you look at these things, like in the same way that when you have children being produced, they're from two adults, like they produce a child in an ideal God-ordained situation. And so with churches, it is staggering to me to look out and just see and like think, why aren't we having more churches where they grow to a point of maturity and then split their church in a healthy way, and then take like one of your elders, one of your mature elders, and maybe one of your guys who's been in your pipeline, and then you go off and start another church, and then you guys stay. Like, why is it that doesn't happen more? Rather than just going out and finding some rando who apparently has qualifications, he graduated from seminary, and we're just going to throw him out there on his own. Like that, it's just baffling to me. It makes no sense. And so there's part of me that, again, I really think this is going to be again, there's going to be a whole mixed bag on what this actually looks like and putting this into practice. This is not some sort of panacea where, oh, now we have patrons and it fixes everything. Like, I don't think that. But I think there being more thought going into doing this slower and planting churches more slowly and more intentionally with a view to generational growth that I think is just going to be a huge blessing to everybody, both the people within the church, the people they're ministering to, and even more. So anybody else, I mean, just, you want anything?
I'd like to jump in. Jim.
Yeah, you've been
I'm the one awful
quiet over there, Jim.
Well, you know, you guys are all the missions, kingdom, pastor people. I'm the, I guess, the token entrepreneur whipping boy here. So I'm going to play devil's advocate. So my mind immediately goes to, where does this initial set of people come from? Like these 10 families that come together and say they want to start a church and don't have a pastor. And like, where does that critical mass come from? I mean, like, just as an example, in our denomination, we're in Utah. There's not many PCA churches in Utah. A lot of the PCA churches that have been planted here have failed. One of the ones that has succeeded recently was planted in St. George. It was a group of four or five families plus a pastor and his family, all from the Chicago area, that all decided together from this church to move to St. George together. And it was kind of like the initial critical mass that then other people could kind of join onto. So what I'm confused about in my mind is, are we just randomly connecting with other Christians in our area in this model, and then just hoping that their doctrines and confessions or whatever they adhere to line up with ours, and that whatever network we end up getting plugged into or whatever denomination we end up getting plugged into in the end does what we want them to do? Or, I mean, this is the Presbyterian coming out. It seems a little disorderly.
Yeah, sure. No, I think that's a great example. So if Jim had 5 to 10 other Westminster Confession guys in an area that said, we need a new church here. We would like to either work with, I'm assuming it's the Western Church Planting Network in Utah. Maybe that's just Colorado, or for the PCA. You would work with them, and or you would summon a pastor that you're like, hey, we want that guy. You know, we like his teaching. So like, this happens a couple of ways. One, I imagine it. One is, I've seen the CRC recently publish a lot of material about like, where they have people that are either consuming their content, I think they call them hotspots,
yep.
And are looking for a pastor. So like in that model, it would be, you've already got people on the ground that are a fan of the CRC, that are a fan of that style of ministry and their particularities. And then they would gather together and say, we're going to pitch in together. In fact, we're going to hire a lawyer, and we're going to start a 501c3, and we're just going to call it whatever church, you know, Round Rock Church. And then we're going to talk to denominational officials and go, hey, is there anyone either graduating from seminary or someone long established, or they have someone in mind? Hey, we want that guy. We're going to call him here to be our pastor. The other way would be...
Before we move on, who's coordinating those people?
Well, Jim would in this case. Yeah.
So like one of the Christians that's in that area is sort of like the de facto kind of leader / coordinator. He's not going to be the pastor. Right. He's sort of the one that's like the ringleader in getting people together. So I guess in that sense, the difference between the rando church planner that just gets sent to Portland and this person is that this person isn't going to end up becoming the pastor, and they're not going to be dependent upon the tithes from that church for their salary.
Yeah, this person is not a pastor I'm thinking of. These people are, none of the people in that core group aspire to the ministry. They don't feel called to ministry. They're Christians who have a common understanding, whether it's Baptistic or Westminster Confession, and they link arms. And like you would do with any kind of, you know, entrepreneurial task, you would divvy up the work and try to figure out how to get it done. So that's one way. The other way is, you know, for mega churches, you have a lot of people in mega churches who go there for a variety of reasons. And in those mega churches, you'll get clusters of people who are very like-minded and who actually will start listening to other people. So for example, this is a negative example of mega churches, but like in our area, when the great shutdown happened, a lot of our church members started listening before we were able to get online spun up. They started listening to Village Church with Matt Chandler. And Matt Chandler was like going in a direction that we were not going in terms of racial reconciliation, that kind of stuff. And so then they would start championing Chandler. And that was very concerning to us. But mega churches who do have that platform already have a wide reach, have the same ability of like the denomination like the CRC, where they have an audience somewhere and those people could come together if they valued the local church enough and they could say, we're not interested in just doing online church with Pastor Matt or whoever it is, Pastor Mega Church, McChurch Pastor across the nation. We want to come together. We want to covenant together and we want to have a pastor come shepherd us that's like him, but not him. So that would be another plausible, I think, opportunity in this model.
Each strategy is going to have its strengths and weaknesses. And I think I'm moving away from the charismatic entrepreneurial leader parachute in big Bible Belt money to go reach the pagans in the north. I feel like moving away from that model is really healthy. As you described some of the weaknesses with the bivocational models, it still relies on that ultra equipped and competent guy that can now do both a church planting kind of launch model plus his entrepreneurial endeavors plus he's a faithful husband and dad, and you're like, okay, well, you've just now whittled even a smaller percentage of guys who can do this model that you're promoting. And I think what you're sharing in a lot of ways does, like, as an older model, right? It goes all the way back to this a view of a parish in a specific location, and that a specific group of a community of people are the ones that are say, hey, we want a church, so we're gonna start it ourselves, and we're gonna find and outsource this minister. So I think there's a lot of health there, a lot of sustainable strength. One challenge or maybe one weakness that you'd have to supplement somehow, and maybe you do it by calling an evangelist also. But is the weakness where you're assuming a strong community of believers already that have cohesive doctrine and enough of a cohesive vision to say, let's go do this thing of calling this pastor. Now, so...
Or even if it's not all of them, there has to be one person that's kind of the coordinator that is that has the riz.
Yeah. And then sometimes where I've seen this lead into is like my style church. So the church around me doesn't do my style of church. Maybe I see this in like the age integrated type of expressions, which I relate to. I appreciate. At the same time, I've seen it go way too far within the Christian homeschool movement where it's like, okay, well, no one does it right. We have the one right way to do it. And so then we're gonna create church around how we want to do church.
Mm.
Like, and the rest of the world be damned. Now that's not really what they're saying, but really I'm like the opposite pendulum swing of we're so missional that you can't even tell we're Christian. When you walk in the door, it's just like I'm at the rave, right? Or I'm at the indie concert. So, but the opposite pendulum swing is we actually haven't asked any questions about how unreached is our community, what are their needs, like, and it's all like opposite of community research. It's just, what do we want? Okay, now I finally have a church and a pastor that I like. So how do you foresee counteracting some of that inward tendencies that happen with churches over time? But you could even start a church that's just like, well, we're just, and we check all our boxes and we've just painted ourselves into this little unique corner that only us and my 12 friends like our church.
That's great. Yeah, that's a great point, because I've seen house churches, I don't know if it's fair to say they're more unhealthy than healthy typically, but what I've noticed is like from what I've seen, they have been, especially when they're like incredibly egalitarian to a point where like, we don't have a leader, you know, and it's very like they have no interest in growing. They have no interest in reaching other people or ministering to other people. It's very insular. One meta question that you're raising, I think, and that you touch on is the purpose of church planting itself. What I was sold was the kind of evangelism model of we start churches. I think the Wagner study is the most cited resource about this, where the most effective way to reach new people for Christ is to plant a church. And, you know, when I got into church planning, I was kind of swept up in the Young Restless Reformed, the excitement, the opportunity. And it wasn't so much like status. Like, I knew moving to Boulder and being a pastor wouldn't give me status with the local population. People here don't respect pastors that much. And so it wasn't about that. It was more like I wanted to serve the Lord. But with the entire church planting model we have today and the understanding of why churches exist, I think a lot of church planters haven't wrestled with that, and a lot of networks and denominations haven't wrestled with that, because they've assumed already that evangelism is the chief end of man. It's the chief goal. It's like the purpose of a church plan. And you're right, there should be an interest in that core group or that church plant to minister to the community. What are the needs here? What are the questions you're asking? This is actually the good stuff that Tim Keller talked about. It can't go too far in my estimation, because I ended up, you know, subscribing to New York Times and reading that after church every Sunday. And that was just way too much for me. But
we're about to get Chase canceled. He just said positive things about Tim Keller. His whole brand is going to go out the door, man. I'm so sorry.
No, I'm going to make a lot of people mad, because I'm going to
edit it out, Chase.
He's going to be repackaged and repurposed for different reasons than he would appreciate, in my mind. And so I do think there's bigger questions that we need to ask when we think about churches and church planting. Is we've all been sold a bill of goods that the whole purpose is to reach lost people. And like Oshawa mentioned earlier, you're not going to reach a sustainable point as a church plant, both financially, discipleship, if you're just, you know, evangelizing people. There are great evangelists out there who reach people. But often a lot of those models are very like, we'll use the word enculturated, right? They're very like with Acts 29, it was like, we asked the question early on, 3 years into Acts 29, we're like, why do we all look the same? Like, why is there not, like, I thought that you were using the word diversity on stage, but everyone's wearing the same Nike shoes and everyone likes craft coffee and soccer. Why is that? Because we don't seem to be very different. Where are the people that like live in rural areas that wear camo and voted differently than some of the people in action? Like, where are we planting churches there? And so that was always a question for me. And so I think a lot of the evangelism stuff is actually just like, it's motivated by different things. And I think it's actually more like, I want to go where the vibes are, where it's cool, where it's a great place to live. And it turns out for a lot of those church planters that moved to the urban corridor, they contact me and they're like, I've made a huge mistake. And they leave because it's really hard there and really difficult. And it wasn't this like cool hot coffee shop hipster experience. It was like, you know, gunshots and like that kind of thing. And so, yeah, there's a lot of questions I still have. They're open-ended to me as far as the history of church planting and the way we've understood it today in terms of its purpose. And I say that as someone who's planted a church, still plants churches, believes in church planting, but I want it to be appropriate. I don't want it to be, like we've said, like a panacea where it's like the solution to the evangelism problem or the lost problem is church planting. I'm like, yeah, but why? Why should a new church be started anywhere? And like, what is the motivation behind that? For me, what I've tried to encourage church planters to do is like, your ministry is to churches. And this is the last thing, because I'm kind of rambling here. Your ministry is to Christians who come to worship. Out of that should flow evangelism opportunities, discipleship, loving neighbors, that kind of thing. But it's about the worship of the living God. Instead, what I heard from the platform and a church planting network I was part of was how much pastors hated pastoring Christians. And how much they actually would put on pastors and bind them to say, if you are not spending 20% of your time out there with the lost, you are failing as a church planter. And I just sat there and I was kind of like, that's a weird thing to say. Like, that's just a weird, like, you planted a church to become a pastor. Like, you didn't, like, to pastor Christians. Like, of course your time is going to be sucked up by Christians. And so if you want to go be evangelist, I guess go street preach, but none of them have the balls to do that, because that's like fundamentalist. And so like, I just get really baffled by the obsession with church planting as only evangelism. So that was a long answer. It's a lot of what Oshawa didn't say, but we have a common kind of background. So I just wanted to riff on that.
Go for it, Tim.
Chase, going off of your thing about ministry being about worship and gathering God's people to worship, I've been thinking a lot lately about the sacrificial system in the Old Testament and how you bring these animals, you bring your offerings, you bring your gifts, you'd be generous to God. And for the most part, you're just setting them on fire. And that's it. They're gone. And the point, or at least half the point, is that you don't have it anymore. And you gave it to God. And God's going to do something with that. And God's going to teach you. And it's like, okay, yeah, some of it goes to feed the priests. Some of it you get to enjoy and eat yourself, all these things. But that seems to me to be very different than most of the way that we think about giving money today in the church. Eugene Peterson talks a lot in his books about how most church life is really kind of a form of consumerism. The pastor is there to serve the customer and to keep them happy and to keep them around. And I wonder, you know, if the emphasis, let's say, okay, we're not going to do as much external funding, we're going to go for internal funding. Okay, great. You know, that might help with some things, but I still wonder, is there a huge need for discipleship in terms of what is the point of giving money in a church? Because I suspect most Americans think I'm paying to get something. I'm paying for a service. And so most churches revolve around building programs and being exciting and keeping something that people will want to come to and think is really cool. When I was doing church revitalization in Austin, I would sometimes drive by these really big program heavy mega churches and I would just feel really discouraged. Like, what am I even doing? People want it. People want that.
Yeah.
They don't really want to come and worship God. And it feels kind of crazy to tell them, yeah, kind of half the point of you giving your money is for God to teach you something by taking it away from you. And it's not like you pay it and you get to get something back out of it, or you see lots of exciting, spectacular results. And with us talking to Bitcoiners a lot and thinking a lot about how do you help Christian Bitcoiners become more faithful disciples, I sometimes wonder if this is going to be a huge struggle and a huge need, because Bitcoiners tend to be so excited about their Bitcoin and they tend to be so slow to part with it that I'm afraid that they, when they do want to part with it by giving it to ministry or to missions, they will expect very unrealistic things about it.
Yeah.
How would you help people in terms of this patronage idea and being generous to your own church and your own pastor? How do you move away from this consumerism model where you're going to get all kinds of services and programs out of this?
Yeah. The way we've discipled, because we've done giving initiatives, we're about to do one again at our church. And the way we always talk about it is because there are capital campaigns out there that are very much like build a building or whatever initiative that's cool, you know, coffee shop or whatever. It could be a litany of things that people kind of glom onto. But for us, and for what I try to teach with giving, is so much of it is about you going to the Lord first, because all of your finances are a gift from Him. So whether you have Bitcoin or not, whatever you've been given is ultimately from Him. It belongs to Him. Mm-hmm. And so the question in our giving isn't, well, I give my 10% to this local church and I expect results, or, you know, it should be a good investment, it should be a wise steward. It's actually like the number 10% can be a useful metric, but it kind of misses the point. And I'll be transparent here, like early on in my Christian life, that was how I thought about giving, was like, okay, I got to pay, you know, at the time I didn't own a home. So rent, bills, you know, apparently women need to get their nails done. And so I had to put that in the budget. And, you know, like all this kind of stuff was kind of baked in. And then at the end of the day, I was like, how much do I have left over? It doesn't exactly match 10%, but, you know, close enough. And so it was the leftovers is what I was giving to the Lord. And what we try to encourage people to do with their giving is go to the Lord. That's a conversation between you and Him, you and your spouse, and say, what is the Lord asking for me in this time? Whether it's particularly at your local church in these cases, but also outside of that, what is the Lord asking for me? And then my whole life is shaped around giving, because the budget flows from our first fruits and it's a response to the Lord's generosity to us. So now my budget itself, if I can't afford Netflix because the Lord has called me to give $20,000 a year to my local church, that is what it is. The Lord has called me to do that and I'm here to sacrifice. Now, what happens with that? That's between the Lord and our church. And I want to hold the church accountable to be good stewards and faithful. At the same time, like, I'm not here to, as an incentive structure, like I'm going to Starbucks and getting a great product on Sundays. I'm here to be a covenant member of this church body and be faithful with what I've got. And so that's kind of how we try to talk about giving. I guess a lot of churches don't talk that way, but that's how we've talked about it. And we as pastors give as well. And that is its own issue. Not personally for me, like I enjoy it because I think I should, but you know, that gets messy in ministry. But yeah, I think it can be hard for people because you do sense that as a pastor, especially in the early years of a church plant, you want to raise up givers as a discipleship thing, but also because you need to put food on the table for your family as a man and provide for your family. And so there can be this temptation to compromise, you might say. and do programs that the people want. And for whatever reason, I'm just hopefully stubborn in a good way. I don't know what the positive of stubborn is, where it's like, I'm just like, I didn't move here and do this and sacrifice time away from my family in Texas and feel a call in the ministry for that. And if that means I need to go, then I need to go. But I'm not playing that kind of game. Like, I'm not interested in that. That's not spiritual maturity to me. That's not what a church is. And if we encounter those kind of people, we try to challenge them. We've had people approach us, hey, we want to give you this money for these purposes, and there's going to be interest. And we're like, yeah, that's not what this is. This is not how the church works. So I totally get that concern, but that's kind of how we've talked about it at our church.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah, yes. Dumb question. So in the Old Testament, the other 11 tribes of Israel had to pay a tithe to support the Levites, right? So that was actual money. And then there was also the sacrifices that also had to come out of their own money. So there was like a pretty clear distinction. But nowadays we don't have sacrifices. We just have giving money. So are we supposed to just lump all those into one big category and assume that part of our money is going to get set on fire? Or like, I'm trying to understand what point Tim and Chase just made.
a lot of the sacrifice, the animal sacrifices would have gone to feed the priest. That was where their food came from.
Yeah.
I think it's,
but the fat was the Lord's.
Exactly.
They were all carnivores, right? Amen. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Yeah.
The priest got actually the brisket, from what I understand. That was like the choice cut. So
they had some land too around all the cities and stuff. And it's like, yeah, obviously it probably would not be a good idea for a church to say, bring your money up here. We're going to set it on fire. But that actually may be helpful for a lot of people. I mean, it may be a good discipleship thing of like, hey, it's gone. We sent it to the Lord. You're going
to
be back.
Like, we're going to burn your sats, like send it to this address and nobody knows what the words are.
Then I mean, probably good for a lot of Bitcoiners of like, you're going to choose to give this up and to no apparent purpose, except that like, this is for God and God's going to teach you to trust him. But yeah, I mean, I'm not advocating that churches should be purposefully wasteful or they should spend the money on stupid things or anything, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, Chase, you talked about how with this different model of church planting, there needs to be pastors who are content with small beginnings. And I sometimes wonder, how do you teach congregations to be content with small pastors in terms of things that are not very impressive and spectacular? You know, one of the blessings of being in America is that there's a lot of churches, but one of the curses that comes with that is your people can very easily just bail. They're like, well, that church has a better youth group. I'm out of here. And so like you're saying, Chase, there is this real pressure to like, how do I keep everybody happy and keep them around?
I know.
They're not content with like, hey, guess what? I'm teaching you the word. You're worshiping the Lord. I'm feeding you the supper and I'm watching out for your marriage and your family. And people are like, well, that's not good enough. I don't like that.
Even though it's crazy.
What most pastors have been doing for most of history.
Yeah. And I will say for the first 8 years of our church plant, I had no idea how to handle that. Like I tried my best, but like for Kim and I, my wife and I, that was the most difficult part of church planting. Not the finances, not the leadership problems, whatever they may have been. It was, we built, like we were the missional community model church and we had built what we thought were like friends and community. And the unfortunate thing is when a church member leaves, like they think we're still going to see each other and we typically don't. And that was incredibly painful for us because we were immature mainly. It wasn't like these people were mean, but we just didn't understand. We were like, I thought we had done the whole like thing. We're like, we're not here to consume. We're not consumer, you know? And then, you know, well, you don't have a good youth group. Or, you know, I move 5 minutes further away. And so, you know, and I'm gone and I'm going to go to the mega church. And I'm like, you were the one saying you didn't like the mega church 5 years ago. So it's just, it's very weird. It's very taxing on all pastors, but I will say particularly for church planters, because it's so tied in, like it's so small. And so I believe like when I share kind of like my vision for church planting, I always joke that if I were to go to church plant again, I just want to do a really simple model of ministry, like from the start. And it's just like, I'll lead the music. I was all-state choir in high school. I could probably like learn to read music again and I could, you know, lead from a hymnal and we can have a basket we pass or something for offerings. And I want to come visit you and do pastoral visits. We're not going to have kids ministry. And it'd be nice to have a building, you know, that'd be nice, but we don't have to. And just really simple model and not like this show. This like
right.
industry.
Yeah. I kind of fantasize about that kind of thing too. But like probably most cities, that church would end up being quite small.
Yeah.
Because most Christians don't want that and they don't like that. And it would be hard to pay you enough to survive. So does it, in a way, become a roundabout argument for a form of external funding or a form of the kind of money that like J.K. Rowling or Scott Adams has, where
sure,
you
no,
have your own wealth, you can kind of just do whatever you want and you don't care and you don't need the people to pay you?
Yeah, it just depends. It depends on a lot of the people and a lot of the context. So like in Boulder County, the average income, I believe, is $100,000 per family. And so you get 10 families giving 10% of their income as $100,000. Like that's, you got a pastor. I mean, that's to me how simple, maybe I'm simple minded right. in that way, but that's like,
yeah. I mean, it's like,
it may not grow. Like you're right. Like maybe they don't, but they're going to have kids and like, you know, they're going to grow right. and you know, like it's not a machine that you're trying to build like a business. It's
right. Yeah. Different. But the flip side of it is that at least half the people in your church aren't going to give any money at all. And they're sure. half of the ones that are left are only going to give you a tiny bit. And you only have a few families that really give significantly. And so you actually need way more than 10 families to get $100,000 out of them.
Yeah, that could be true.
I mean, I hear that and like, I get it. I get that it's reality, but like reality is a sliding scale thing, right? And so like, I just think like, this is where like, as a pastor, like I think a lot of what you're talking about, we talk about this a lot of, like we're in this ontological crisis of like, nobody knows what anything is. We don't know what men are. We don't know what women are. We don't know what churches are. We don't know what pastors are. We don't know what church members are. And so like some of this is—
We know what they are in the PCA.
All right. Sure. Cool. Cool. Yeah. I always say so much. Yeah. But so like, this is the thing. What are things? And so I think a lot of this, I mean, I honestly think we're going to have, like, we've seen a lot of crumbling since 2020. And I think like some of this, it's been so good that a lot of these things have crumbled. A lot of these, there's denominations that are shrinking, denominations that are disappearing. I think a lot of this needs to happen so that we can kind of get back to, again, asking these questions. We're both on the people who are church members asking these questions like, wait, what are we even doing this for? Because like, it is just so easy to get into this situation of it's just total pragmatism. It's total pragmatism of, yeah, this is what I want. This is convenient for me, blah, 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 blah. I'm like having this conversation with some friends over the past like 3 months and guys who've spent more time in mega churches and who are just like dealing with this in real time. Like, what does this actually look like? How do we, you know, get away from just only thinking about the pragmatic side of ministry? And I was dinking around on YouTube and came across this video called The Revival Hymn. Have any of you guys seen this thing? Oh man, it's so good. It's basically like a 28 minute video with, it's like a compilation of some of the best sermons that have ever been preached in English. There's like guys, Leonard Ravenhill and like Paris Reedhead, this famous sermon called 10 Shekels in a Shirt. Have you guys heard of this? It's a fantastic thing. It's like 25 minutes long. There's like things they talk about, different revivals that have happened. And so some of it's, again, it's got like Last of the Mohicans music in it. It's super, super epic in a lot of ways. But one of
sounds
the-
so pietistic, Jordan. These are a bunch of like Reformed Presbyterians on this call. They don't do all those like, yeah, goosebump.
That's right. But stuff. Again, that's fine. So one of the things that they talk about in this video though, is he talks about, it's, I think it's Paris Reedhead. He went to Africa to be a missionary. And he talked about, he's like, I had seen pictures of ulcers. I'd seen pictures of people suffering. And he's like, and I went there. He's like, I wouldn't have put it this way. He's like, but I really went to Africa to minister, to relieve the suffering of my fellow man. I didn't think it was fair that these people would suffer and not have the chance to hear the gospel and go to, you know, go to heaven when they died. He's like, so I got there and realized that these people had a far greater knowledge of God than I ever could have imagined. And once I got there and went there to preach the gospel, these people, they didn't want to come to our meetings. They didn't want to come to these things. And he just talks about in this sermon, he says, in this one day I had it out with the Lord in prayer. And he's like, and I said to the Lord, it's a fine thing you've done bringing me out here to preach the gospel to these people who have no desire to, you know, I get out here, find these people who have no desire to hear the gospel. And he just basically, he says something epic like, and in that moment, I heard a voice that wasn't an audible voice, but it was like the voice of the ages speaking into my heart or something. And he's like, and God basically said to me in that moment, I didn't send you to Africa for their sake. I sent you to Africa for my sake. I love them and I endured the agonies of hell for them. Like, do I not deserve the suffering, like the reward of my suffering, basically? Do I not deserve those for whom I died? And so he has like this whole epic thing where he's like, and that righted it all and it changed it all. And now all of a sudden I wasn't Micah working for 10 shekels in a shirt. I was serving the living God. And so like, obviously that's super intense and all these things. But like, I really do think that's a big part of like what we really need is like, you have so many pastors and so many people whose vision of ministry is super pragmatic. And they just really need to like re-encounter this, like before there's any person there, there is God. Like God is there. You're ministering to him. And that's like a humongous thing. And so obviously there are others of us who we're already on that degree. Like we're there for the Lord, and who we're struggling because we don't have the resources or we don't have these things. And so again, the Lord's going to work in and through all of these things. But I just think there's so many people and there's a hunger for it. There's people who are sensing that there's something missing. They're sensing that, you know, we've lost something. They're sensing like an absence. And I think just a real part of it is like, yeah, you've basically done lots of great ministry. You've proven what you can do without God. You can do with like lots of spreadsheets, lots of resources, monetary resources. You can do lots of things, but you're not going to accomplish, and see some of the real ministry that God has, God does, which is in weakness and lack and in humility, and not impressive ministry. So
with every head bowed, every eye closed. If you feel the Lord speaking to you right now.
That's right. Yep.
Just give me a spreadsheet and I'll plant 30 churches for you. Just off spreadsheets alone.
It's true. Man does not live by spreadsheets alone, Jen.
I will say, Jordan, on kind of some of what Tim talked about was, I don't know what you guys have seen, but for me when I minister, especially in a place like Boulder, there's a lot of Christians who are interested in kind of like first century Christianity. This was very popular. When you get back to the real Jesus. So the danger... Yes. In a lot of that, and even my kind of like fantasy, like, you know, simple church stuff, is that we cater to a kind of primitivist kind of instinct, and we don't have a long-term vision for culture and building a church that is a place of worship that's beautiful, and it can lend itself towards a unhelpful. And those are some of the most frustrating people I encounter, because I'm coming at ministry with hopefully a long-term vision of planting a thriving church that has families, that grows, that reaches the lost, and that lasts. And these people are just like, well, we don't need to. They're just at the bottom line. They're anti-institutional, right? They hate authority.
Correct.
They have this fantasy world that if we live without indoor plumbing and walked around in sandals, somehow we'd be more spiritual. And I'm like, this is dumb thinking. Please stop.
Correct.
But there's an overlap there. And that's my frustration. It's like, there's a bit of an overlap, but we end up diverging very wildly because that's not my vision at all.
And I think I 100% agree. I think part of the danger and part of the problem is it's the C.S. Lewis quote about you have guys in the storm who are bailing out the wrong side of the ship. Like they're basically going to fall into the water because they're doing there is a right instinct, but it's completely, they're the wrong people to be hearing it. And so I think it's like you have the people who are willing to do whatever for the Lord, who are reticent to mention their monetary needs because they're scared of being unspiritual. And then you have the other people who are doing the exact opposite thing. So it's like, I totally recognize all of the dangers on both sides, but it's just like, it really is. The solution is not to not talk about one or the other. Just like the solution is not with, the solution is not to talk about, finances. You know, for fear of talking too much about it, it's to talk about it as much as the scriptures talk about it. It's to, preach the whole counsel and not just over spiritualize or glamorize poverty or, under spiritualize, wealth or whatever. I think there's just the dangers abound.
So I wonder if we can do both and Chase, I don't know if you remember this.
Look at Osh with the third wayism. Look at him. Oh man, the true Kellerite.
I'm all about it. I don't know if you remember this. Early XY9 days, I think it was Driscoll or someone, or maybe it was a Daryl Gooder kind of gospel on our culture network, missional church people, where they said your ecclesiology has to flow out of your missiology. Right? And then that leads to a whole lot of confusion around the relationship of the church and the world, the kingdom, and the church and all that. But I wonder if you can have this. So here's this community of people in a parish community that say, let's call a pastor. And that pastor comes and he sees his calling as caring for the flock, right? He's a pastor teacher. But at the same time, whether it's that same community of people or maybe it's a missionary focused type of organization or entity that says, let's call a missionary to this place and this community. Let's call an evangelist. And so you have a distinction in the callings, which we kind of already do, but we in the missional church movement just threw them all together and said, you're a missionary, now go.
Everyone's a missionary. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Or everyone's a missionary, so start acting like it. But I thought I was supposed to be a dad and father and no, I throw that doesn't matter. Missionary. What if you have those distinctions within the DNA of a church where you start with the big stone of, hey, this is pastoral care. This is ministry to the Lord. This is boring Sunday services because that's what we've been called to do. Disciple the saints on Sunday. And then you recognize there is a missionary calling. There is a need for an evangelist. And we're going to call those two. We may even financially support them so they can do the whole, I just hang out in coffee shops and go to parks and talk to people. And, or maybe they join the speech club and they start like, or they go to the local high school, like just be radical, be creative, go and reach the lost. But we don't categorize those things.
Yeah.
Can we do both?
I think so. I mean, one of the models out there is like campus outreach. We live in a college town, so I've explored that. That's a huge financial burden that we couldn't afford at the time. But that would be an example of that, right? We can't afford a college ministry. We can't afford an evangelist, that kind of thing. But yeah, even like, partnering with ministries, this can be difficult. But those people have to be bought in. We've experienced the same thing with parachurch campus ministries, you know, where it's difficult for them to submit to local church leadership. And so yeah, I totally think it's doable. The conception of evangelism, like you joked about a coffee shop. That is, I'm afraid for many people, like that's their conception. And, you know, I want to encourage a bit more of a public, you know, like even just go knock on doors, you know, just like go meet people in a different way, you know, try something different. Because I don't know, like in Boulder, when I see someone with a Bible out, I'm like, I immediately do a beeline to them because like a Christian, amazing. You know, I want to get to, where do you go to church? And hopefully they say a good one, you know, the conception of what evangelism is and having an arm of the church that does that, or at least a part of that DNA, I think that's totally legitimate. But I think it's been utterly unhelpful for me personally, and for people I minister to, when I put that burden on them, where it's like, hey, everyone's a missionary, everyone is this. And this is a total flattening of any kind of hierarchy, any kind of responsibilities and duties before the Lord that confuses so many categories.
Mm-hmm. Are we on the right track, Reverend Fox?
I approve this message.
All right, we've been going for about an hour and 7 minutes. Again, anybody else have any more questions? Any things they want to drag Chase over the coals over? All right, we solved the problem. Let's go. We've solved church planting. This is great news. I'm sure everyone will be thrilled.
Now launching the Bitcoin Church Planting Network.
Let's go. There we are. So I guess... Chase, as you're looking at this, what are some of the things, I mean, that you have, I guess maybe some of the more of the pitfalls. I mean, you guys have planted a bunch of churches. You guys, have seen probably a lot in the last 10 years. And again, feel free, any of you other guys to chime in. What are some of the things that maybe as if there's church people, church members who are watching this, or people who are Christians, maybe who aren't involved in churches, what are some of the traps that you've seen people fall into that seem logical in the moment, but that just are just like cultural traps or just individual, just normal sin traps that you just have seen people? I mean, we talked about radical individualism, where it's just like, me and my family, we do church at home. What are some of the other things maybe that you've seen, I guess maybe in the last few years, that you feel like could be helpful to help people think about in their own hearts and then maybe identify in other people who they might be ministering alongside?
I mean, for me, the biggest one that I've seen, and I haven't seen this in the churches necessarily that we've planted, but with the church planting is evangelism. And if I were speaking to other church planters and if I got in a room, this would be the thing I would want to talk about is what is the church and why do we plant churches? Because when we think of it solely in terms of evangelism reaching the lost, this is why I even pick on evangelism and the methods we use, because many times that's where the compromise comes theologically and all sorts of other issues. And so if we're there to plant a church, we're there to plant a church, to shepherd Christians, to feed the flock, and yes, reach the lost. That will come, and we can put an emphasis on evangelism. Americans love evangelism, so you're going to have to, you know, talking about the consumer model, this is like a big problem in American evangelicalism is how much of the ministry is outward facing. And I think it boils down to that church planter who's entrepreneurial, who's got the riz, who's got the charisma. They're very used to being well-liked. And that attracts a certain person who's used to being like kind of not the center of attention, not that they want to be the center of attention, but like having a good reputation, not necessarily as the Bible says, but a good reputation, like our neighbors want to come over to our house. And I think that traps a lot of church planters into thinking that one, if the lost actually don't like them, they're doing something wrong. Or two, we're going to pursue being approved by the lost. And, you know, if the sheep are upset, that's fine. They're fuddies anyways. They don't really know all the cool gadgets and I'm networked and I've been approved. And so this is what real church is. And so we're going to dismiss the needs of this flock and what they want, which is good Bible teaching on important topics. And we're going to cater to the needs of lost. So now the sermons and all of our ministry is geared towards people outside of our church. And that is that's not just for church planters, that's for pastors, but that particularly is a problem in church planting.
I lived in Scotland for 4 years, and living there it really opened my eyes and challenged me to think about ministry in very secular contexts. And one of the things that really challenged me there was that it is so post-Christian that it doesn't matter how good your programs are or how spectacular it is. People just won't come to church because it's completely bizarre and weird. And you're like three generations deep of just nobody going to church. And they just never will darken the door of a church. But at the same time, and so, you know, the classic traditional Scottish church has 10 really old people who are faithful and they come and they sit there. But, you know, they're dying. The churches are dying. And so there is this sense. And so I do want to defend evangelism a little bit. And maybe you're not trying to totally poo-poo evangelism.
I'm not.
But there was this sense in Scotland in terms of ministry that we do need to feed the flock because they won't get it anywhere else. And there are not very many churches at all that will actually teach them the Bible. But if we are going to survive, we do need to reach people. But it wasn't a program-driven, spectacular, let's try to attract them type of reach the lost. It was a, we need to kind of be in people's lives and inviting them over to our house and getting to know them, which is, you know, really hard in Scotland because people are just culturally a little more standoffish and weirded out by Christians. But at the same time, you know, it's just, it takes a really, really long time. I mean, like years and years and years and years with people. And so I don't know. You're not saying this, but I don't think we need to choose between nurture the flock with solid Bible teaching or reach the lost. And in some ways, one of the things I admired about my friends in Scotland and their ministry was that it was the unashamed, deep Bible teaching that did attract non-Christians or things that they were, I mean, when they were ready to hear it, they really wanted to hear the real deal and not just like the superficial, sugary version of it. Yeah, I don't know. Evangelism doesn't just mean do crazy, spectacular programs, but it doesn't mean it's going to be easy or happen quickly.
I wonder if we could close on Jim riffing a little bit about his vision for gospel patronage and what it has to do with Bitcoin. We've actually talked a fair bit about this, and it is a Bitcoin podcast after all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea is a little bit different than Chase's idea of patronage. But I think it overlaps, you know. At the end of the day, we're trying to orange pill the church. We're trying to Jesus pill Bitcoiners. We're trying to get the most possible Bitcoin into the hands of Christians. And so that's just step one, though. What happens whenever Bitcoin goes to the moon and there are a bunch of Christians that have a bunch of Bitcoin? What are they going to do with it? And I think this is what Tim was kind of getting to in his original question. It's how do you disciple people now before that happens so that they're ready for it. And in the worst case, you know, so they don't end up swerving off and going the worldly way and rejecting the faith. But in the best case, actually turn around and use it for the kingdom. Presumably not just lighting it on fire like a burnt offering, but something will come back somehow, somewhere, right? Like we're not just lighting it all on fire. Like we're going to use some of it for the kingdom. So
yeah, the most important thing to come back is that you grow in dependence on God.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. I think one of the other things that, I mean, we kind of think about and talk about these things a lot, but maybe on Chase's front, like one of the things that we, like ministering in Uruguay for 7 years, one of the things that we saw was like late stage currency devaluation. You run into this thing where in Uruguay where we were, their currency has failed 3 times since 1971 when the U.S. went off of a gold standard. And so what you have is you have churches that were planted 40, 50 years ago who, you know, had resources, they had people, they were growing. And then as the currency fails, imagine you're saving, you know, you're saving in that local currency and you're saving up to hire another pastor or saving up to build a building or whatever it is. If you're denominating your savings in that currency and then it gets devalued down to nothing, like you've effectively been saving in vain. And so this is a big part of like what we're looking at is like, you know, this thing that we're experiencing where we look at this, we look at kind of in the States, we're like, oh, this is just COVID related. And it's like, no, this has been going on for a lot longer. And it's going to get a lot worse because right now the only thing that the government, the only lever that they have is just print more money. And so the effects that this is going to have and is having on church planting is it's going to get more and more difficult to fund churches because the margin that even normal people have right now is just going to get whittled down over time. If you're denominating and saving and still living and thinking in a currency that Joe Biden, President Trump could just go out there and create more units of, trillions more units of, with the push of a button. And so that's a big part of what we're thinking is just like, we look at the, you know, we're going to do a whole episode on this, but like we look at the history of the movements of the gospel for the last 2000 years and whoever has held the reserve currency has been able to, in wherever ministry has been happening, it's centered around this reserve currency and whoever is ministering in the areas that holds and lives within this reserve currency, they are able to do far more ministry than places where that's not happening. It doesn't mean that people in these other places don't have the responsibility to preach the gospel. Of course they do. But you're able to do a lot more ministry in the places where you have a more stable currency. And so we basically look at Bitcoin in stewarding resources into Bitcoin as a way to kind of, you know, acknowledge this historical reality, acknowledge this reality that God has made the world to operate a certain way. He's made, this principle of sowing and reaping, that actions have consequences to govern everything. And we can't just try to make the world operate the way that's convenient to us, where we can just, debt is just money we owe ourselves. And, you know, where we can just act like little gods in the world. This is fundamentally a broken and deficient and unsustainable way to operate in the world. And so so we're just basically trying to help churches and nonprofit organizations and just individuals acknowledge and help them see this historical reality and then Bitcoin as one tool in the tool belt to help to help basically overcome and negate some of the consequences that this has had throughout time. So does anybody else have anything else they want to add before we hit the road here? All right. Chase, appreciate you, brother. Grateful for you. And again, to all of you who are watching, go follow Chase on Twitter. I refuse to, you know, call it by the third to last letter of the alphabet. Go follow him. Go support what he's doing. Again, Chase, tell everybody where they can find you beyond Twitter.
Yeah, I just started a Substack. That's where the article came from. So you can go subscribe on Substack, jchasedavis.substack.com. You can find me at Foolproof Theology, where I have interview conversations, FULL Proof Theology.
Yep. I've been on Chase's podcasts and would love to see some of these guys on over there. No pressure, Chase. But yeah, we'll see you guys on the next episode of To the Unknown Pod. We'll be back on Tuesday, I think, with the Island Boys. So look forward to that. Chase, grateful for you. Guys, we'll see you on the next episode.